The Guardian.
This podcast is sponsored by audible.co.uk, the number one online destination for digital audiobooks.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
What do you know?
I know you and your wife were attacked by something you think was a wolf. I know your wife was killed, and you were seriously injured.
Good evening. This is Crime Classics. I know that you're I am bad. Thomas Highland.
You shouldn't have been completely healed 3 weeks after the attack.
Ali Pasha, on his way to visit his mother. A Sunday afternoon. And he always visited his mother on Sunday afternoon. It was a thing she could count on.
The man you hear breathing is named Thomas Edwin Barton. He is in bed and sleeping, breathing deep the night air of Pimlico, England. An almost lullaby quality for young Mrs. Adelaide Bartlett, his wife, who this night sleeps at the foot of his bed. Rhythmical. Serene. And just at the stroke of midnight, just when a new year has begun, Mr. Bartlett stops breathing. Mr. Bartlett has just died from having drunk too much chloroform, of all things.
Crime novels, murder mysteries, crime and police dramas, and amateur detectives fill our bookshelves and TV screens.
It's like every slide is some...
Is another story, yes. Every crime scene is a story, is a novel.
Just in case you hadn't yet picked up the clues, this week's podcast is all about crime fiction. We'll be talking to detective-turned-crime writer Joseph Wombau and private investigator-turned-thriller writer Michael Kurita. Plus, we'll get some tips from academic Peter Messant about the history of this venerable genre, or series of genres. But first, let's begin with some mood music from one of the shooting stars of the thriller writing firmament, Gillian Flynn, who came in to talk to her number one fan, Alison Flood.
When I think of my wife, I always think of her head, the shape of it to begin with. The very first time I saw her, it was the back of the head I saw, and there was something lovely about it, the angles of it, like a shiny hard corn kernel or a riverbed fossil. She had what the Victorians would call a finely shaped head. You could imagine the skull quite easily. I'd know her head anywhere. And what's inside it, I think of that too, her mind. Her brains, all those coils and her thoughts shuttling through those coils like fast, frantic centipedes. Like a child, I pictured opening her skull, unspooling her brain and sifting through it, trying to catch and pin down her thoughts. What are you thinking, Amy? The question I've asked most often during our marriage, if not out loud, if not to the person who could answer. I suppose these questions storm cloud over every marriage. What are you thinking? How are you feeling? Who are you? What have we done to each other? What will we do? My eyes flipped open at exactly 6 a.m. This was no avian fluttering of the lashes, no gentle blink toward consciousness. The waking was mechanical, a spooky ventriloquist dummy click of the lids. The world is black, and then, showtime! 6:00, the clock said. In my face, first thing I saw, 6:00. It felt different. I rarely woke at such a rounded time. I was a man of jagged risings. 8:43, 11:51, 9:26. My life was alarmless. At that exact moment, 6:00, the sun climbed over the skyline of Oaks, revealing its full summer angry god self. Its reflection flared across the river toward our house, a long blaring finger aimed at me through our frail bedroom curtains, accusing, "You have been seen. You will be seen."
Gone Girl is a thriller about what quickly emerges as a pretty toxic married couple, Nick and Amy Dunn, opening as Nick realises their house has been wrecked and Amy has disappeared from their home. And the finger of blame soon starts to swing towards Nick. I wanted to ask if you're happily married.
Yes, I am very happily married. My hope, though, was definitely for people to recognize little bits of their relationships in Nick and Amy and certainly kind of understand that power play of a long relationship and those strange little ups and downs and aggravations and the ability to push each other's buttons, in their case, to a dangerous extent, but to at least for it to feel real.
Yeah, what did your husband have to say about it all?
You know, he was great. It takes a big man when his wife comes to him and says, honey, I'm going to write about the darkest aspects of marriage. And he didn't blink an eye. He said, you know, go for it and, you know, don't censor yourself and put it all out there. And before it was going into production, I made him read it yet another time. And I said, you know, if there's anything that feels too close to home, you know, let me know, because I'd rather stay married than publish this book. And he said, well, first of all, if all feels too close to home, but that's the point, isn't it? You know, that means your book is working.
Yeah.
But he had no specific issues, which was good. I tried to be very careful not to take anything specifically from our lives and keep that a very separate and sacred thing.
So you tell your story through both of their voices, switching back and forth between them. Amy's a trust fund girl who comes across as kind of scarily sunny and happy almost. And Nick is sort of a golden boy who's quite disturbing even from the beginning when he describes the bit that you read, Amy's skull, and how you can imagine it very easily. Did you always know that you'd write from both perspectives, or did that kind of come out as you began?
Yeah, I did not know that, to tell you the truth. I knew I'd tell it from Nick's perspective, since the story begins with Amy missing, as he is going through and very quickly becomes, you know, a suspect in her disappearance, and we're not sure if he's telling the truth or not. Mm. And then I realized that I wanted to get Amy's voice in there somehow. That the more I thought about her and who she was and what their marriage was, I realized I wanted it to feel kind of like a he said, she said story. I wanted the reader to feel that tug between each of them, the way you have when you're in the middle of a fight between friends and, you know, you're with one friend, you think, oh, you know, she's got a point. And then you're with the other friend, you're like, oh, you know, he has got the point too. And I wanted to play with the reader's allegiances of who they thought was telling the truth and who they thought was to be believed.
So you've got a massive twist in the novel, which I'm not going to give away. But I wanted to know if you knew where you were going with that right from the start, or if you started out just with the kind of idea that no one's relationship is knowable.
It seems, yeah. No, I knew the twist. I always knew the twist. I had no clue what was going to happen after that. That part I had to figure out. But we sold it kind of on the basis of that. And so I always knew I was working toward that at some point.
So how do you go about writing your thrillers? Is it kind of research, research, research? Or do you start just with the characters and see where they go?
I really start with the characters. I start trying to figure out who they are, and I do a lot of very old-fashioned writing exercises. You know, I make their iPod playlists, and you know, what Nick, who is a movie buff, what his Netflix list would contain, and almost do kind of a questionnaire about them so that I know them very well. I know, you know, if they eat breakfast and if they remember people's birthdays and where their favorite restaurant would be, and all this sort of thing, so that I'm really kind of forced to dig in and get to know them very well.
Much more than you'd have in the book.
I way overwrite. I do, and that's one of my favorite things to do, is actually to write scenes about these characters from other characters' points of view that obviously aren't going to end up in the book. So I would write scenes from, you know, Nick's, you know, second grade teacher and one of Amy's high school friends and that sort of thing, because that helps me see them from different angles. And it's a really good way, especially if I get writer's block, because that's what I usually kind of do, is back off and take the scene from a different angle. And it's never used, but it's really helpful to me.
Yeah, it must be weird looking back at that once you're done.
It is very strange, and it's fun to see the journey that you take from where you think the character is when you start those really early kind of essays. You know, they're both writers, so I would write essays from their points of view that would have been in a magazine that they published, and to read who I thought they were then, and then I realized that they were as I went farther and farther.
Yeah. So once you're done, I mean, how carefully, when you're going back, to make sure you don't give away too much too early? Is there stuff that has to be cut once you're finished? You're like, oh no, that gives the game away.
It's a real balancing act, because I definitely want all the clues to be there. I don't want the reader to feel cheated, like that they get to a certain spot and think, oh, well, there's no way I could have known that you were withholding information from me, too much information. So I make sure that all that information is there, but you're right. You have to give it in an almost offhand manner so that it doesn't, you know, you don't want anyone to go like, boom, boom, you know, here comes the clue.
It must be so hard for you because you know that it's the clue, and so it's so glaringly obvious.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a lot of volume control. It's a lot of figuring out how much to put in and when and how to do it. And so what I always do is I keep one or two friends. I have about 4 or 5 good friends who read all my stuff early on, including my husband. And I usually keep one or two, and I don't tell them anything about what it is so that they're the control group. I can give it to them, and they don't have any sense of where the story is going, and they're good at telling me.
And how do you keep track of it all? Do you have a system to know who knows what and who said what? And
I have a really unorganized way of organizing, which is basically to write things down on sticky notes and tape and stick them to my wall. So by the end of writing Gone Girl, I just had pieces of just crazy scribblings all over the walls of my office. It looked totally insane.
Would it have made sense to anybody else?
Like Zima, 1987, car, yes, mom, dead, alive, when? You know, just this, just crazy, the writings of a mad woman.
So Nick is a writer, and you describe him as he was a writer back when people read things on paper and back when anyone cared about what I thought. And you used to be a critic for Entertainment Weekly. I was wondering if this was something that came from the heart.
I also was laid off during the big recession in the States when so many magazines were trying to stay afloat. And I knew that that would kind of be my way into Nick. I knew I wanted him to be a character who didn't feel entirely 100% capable. And I knew that something had to have been taken away from him. And so I thought, you know, he was a man who really fought to get his job and loved his job. And then when he lost his job, he lost a really big chunk of who he was and couldn't quite figure out how to define that again. And that certainly is what drives a lot of his inappropriate actions, is that sense that he's keeps talking about not feeling like he has a use and a purpose anymore.
And for you, did you turn immediately to writing novels then when you were laid off?
I do want to say that I was probably the luckiest laid-off person around because I had written the 2 books already. So I kind of started this other career. I'd written the first 2 just on nights and weekends and kept my day job because I'm a very pragmatic person and because I really loved my day job. I did Gone Girl full-time and wrote it full-time and probably overwrote it.
Yeah. And Amy is a New Yorker who's really unhappy when she moves to Missouri with Nick. Did you grow up in Missouri? Is this kind of bad memories of where you grew up?
No, I have great memories of, I love my hometown and home state, but I lived a long time in New York. And so I certainly know the attitude of some New Yorkers toward anything in the middle of the country, which is sort of either disdain or fear. So, and so I kind of wanted Amy to have that sense of like, where are you, you know, I don't know this place that you're taking me at all. Like I've never been to the middle of the country. I've never wanted to go to the middle of the country. And that sense that he's really kind of dragging her away from everything that she's known and to a different place.
Yeah. We quickly come to realize when we're reading it that they're both really unreliable narrators. Did you have a lot of fun with that and with playing with your readers' perceptions of the truth?
Yeah, I love unreliable narrators. It's one of my favorite, as a reader, one of my favorite techniques. I love that sensation of being 30 or 40 pages into a book and trusting the person that you're with and then suddenly realizing that you've given the trust to the wrong person and this narrator's telling their very own certain spin on something. I think it gives a really great queasy feeling to the reader.
I really liked the background that you gave Amy. It was so unusual, the fact that she'd been the inspiration for her parents' a series of children's books, Amazing Amy. Where on earth did that come from, that idea?
It came from kind of reverse engineering Amy, knowing who Amy had to be for to be in that story, then trying to kind of back up and figure out why she was the way she was. And I went back to childhood. She's one of those people who was never given the skills to fail in any way. You know, she's beautiful, she's smart, she's rich. She's never, ever had anything not go her way. And so I thought, oh, yeah, you know, not only is she all these things, she was also kind of idolized in a very weird way by her parents and turned into this kind of icon from an early age. But it's a fame that she didn't earn either, so it's kind of a dangerous thing.
Yeah. So what do you think is next? I mean, I think that you've got a kid, haven't you? Are you going to write something dark and evil about parents and children?
I really, I've thought about that. I don't know if I'd have the stomach for it, to tell you the truth. My first 2 books did have bad things had happened to children in them, and I didn't have a child when I wrote them, and now I don't know. I don't know how that would feel, how that would settle. It'll definitely be dark. It'll definitely be psychological motivated thriller. Yeah, that's just what really interests me.
Gillian Flynn talking there to Alison Flood, and Gone Girl is published by Phoenix. Alison joins me here in the studio to talk to our next two guests, Michael Kurita, whose ninth novel, The Prophet, takes him into a precinct new to him, and Peter Messant, who I hope will help us to decide exactly what precinct that is. Peter, you see, is the author of the newly published Crime Fiction Handbook. So let's start with you, Peter. You're familiar with Gillian Flynn's work, aren't you? Would it have a place on your particular map of crime fiction?
Oh, yes, very definitely. I have, in fact, read Gone Girl, and I think it's sort of one of the best of the novels that's come out recently within the crime fiction genre, partly because, you know, of what she does with narrative, what she does with plot. It is genuinely original of its type, and I think it very definitely would have featured in my book had it come out while I was writing the book.
I feel that there seems to be a thing at the moment, psychological thrillers. Lots of them are written by women, Tana French, Sophie French, Gillian Flynn as well, kind of emotional dramas, psychological thrills. Do you think that that might be the new big thing in this area?
I see sort of the power of crime fiction, at least as it exists in its present European form and possibly American form too, as the way it moves between political critique, depiction of social reality and the problems of contemporary social reality, and psychological fiction. And I think it's that kind of tripartite thrust to the fiction that makes it so important. And certainly when you think of contemporary women's crime writing, and particularly Gillian Flynn, I think, she is, in her use of her central protagonists, very concerned with the workings of their minds and the reflections of the way in which those minds work in relation to the reality around them. And particularly in Gone Girl, I think, with that double centre to Gone Girl with the husband and wife protagonists.
Let's now just move to your classifications. In this book, you come up with four classifications of crime fiction, which two of which we know, classical detective fiction and hard-boiled. But the other two are really interesting, and one is police fiction. You don't like the idea of the police procedural. You think it's too limited a term.
It's quite interesting that actually one of our other guests, Joseph Wombau, is the person who really warned me against that term, in that he said that the term police procedural sort of actually puts in your mind the idea of a beginning, a movement through the resolution of a plot and an ending in a way that in his novels he's just not interested in doing. He's much more interested in, again, following the trajectories of individual plots within his novels, letting them go in all kinds of directions and not having any neat ending at all. But I use the term police novel, and that's what a lot of critics use at the moment, because that just gives us a kind of broader scope for considering a genre which just doesn't take in detectives, doesn't just take in the police force, but takes in people like the FBI. So, for example, the way that Thomas Harris uses his protagonists in the Hannibal series, but also someone like Patricia Cornwell, whose protagonist is affiliated to the police force, to the detective force, but isn't an actual detective.
We'll come back to this later because this relates quite very interestingly to The Prophet, actually. But I just want to come just quickly to your final category, which I had never heard of before, which is transgressive fiction.
So what that means is it would be generally a first-person narrative, but not always a first-person narrative, which is focused on a criminal and sees life from his or her perspective and has a plot which develops around his or her perspective. So again, giving examples, one of the early illustrations of transgressor narratives, which some critics would call literary noir, is something like The Postman Always Rings Twice or Horace McCoy, They She Horses, Don't They? That kind of world, where you're seeing the world from the point of view of the criminal, was used in the 30s in a very deterministic manner, because usually those criminals would end up dead, defeated by the forces of the law. Whereas now you get novels like, again, Gone Girl, which starts off as apparently a conventional crime fiction, but becomes a transgressor narrative. Or again, Silence of the Lambs, in which the figure of Hannibal Lecter and the point of view of Hannibal Lecter is just as important as the point of view of Clarice, the detective.
I'm going to move on to Michael. You've moved quite a bit, generically speaking, haven't you? Do you recognise profit as fitting into any of the categories that Peter's been talking about?
Yes, I think it could fit into a little bit of all of them, really. I don't worry about it, and I think most writers are less concerned about category and genre, and more so story first. I would consider everything that I've written to fall into the field of suspense, with elements drawn from different things. Now, some novels, The Cypress House, So Cold the River, had a supernatural element. The Prophet does not. Within The Prophet, we have a character who's operating at different times in the book as a detective and then as a criminal. So I can see an overlap in a few of the criteria he's establishing there. So I certainly think that, you know, it's a fascinating study to see that idea of the, you called it the transgressant. I think that certainly was a movement that was picked up again. I would consider most of Elmore Leonard's early crime novels to be in that vein, and certainly Kane as well. So, you know, The Prophet would overlap a few of them. But with regard to Gillian Flynn and Gone Girl, I think back to Raymond Chandler's quote about Dashiell Hammett, and he said that Hammett took murder out of the drawing room and the parlor and dropped it back in the alley where it belonged. And I think Gillian Flynn and some other writers are taking murder out of the alley where it's lived in crime fiction for a number of years, and bringing it, I would say, into the bedroom, into more intimate relationships, suburban husband and wife sort of relationships. And that's the trend that I really see happening right now. And I think that that gets to Allison's point about those psychological suspense novels, particularly written by women. And I think it is a new trend, and certainly one that's doing big things.
I guess your book, I mean, it's got classic elements as a tragic murder, a young girl, a brother who blames himself, a present-day murder of another teenager, but you kind of subvert things by, you've got this investigator, but as you say, he's partly investigator, partly turns criminal.
Vigilante at one point in the book, and I wanted to, you know, what I was really dealing with there, and this is where I get back to that idea of not overloading at the beginning of the process, certainly too much concern about what genre expectations there are. To me, The Prophet is a family story. It's about brothers and how they coped in very different ways with the loss of their sister. And so Adam is a bail bondsman and a private investigator, and his initial goal is find the guilty party. However, in the traditional detective sense, find the guilty party would be bring them to justice. Adam's vision of justice is a vision of pure revenge. So at that point that he becomes a vigilante, then he's acting as a criminal. And so I think he's playing dual roles throughout the book.
Explain to us here in the UK what a bail bondsman is, because we don't have them here.
That's a great question, because only in America and the Philippines, it's an insurance company, essentially, would front the money that allows you to get out of jail. Now, a portion of this sum, 10% in most states, would be a non-refundable sum. And so that's what's paying the bail bondsman his salary. If you fail to appear in court, it is up to him to go find you. So you become sort of a free world jailer, and you're responsible for everyone who you hold a bond on. Adam's sister was murdered by someone who had skipped out on bond. And so this is what drew him into the profession. And he takes very, very seriously the idea that every one of his wards will always appear in court.
It's such a great character for a crime novel, because he kind of bridges the criminal and the police elements of the book. It's quite unique.
Thank you. And I think it's a unique profession in that regard, because you have to have contacts within that criminal world to find these guys when they go missing. You know, you have to have contacts and trust and be able to work within it, because you don't have a badge. You don't have the authority of police. It allowed Adam to do some things that the classic private investigator could do, and also still work within the criminal justice system.
Peter, you talk about all different sorts of investigators. You introduce us a wonderful word, isolato, who's an isolato within the police force. Where do you think the bondsman fits into your particular palette of investigators?
In American crime fiction, I'm thinking of the Janet Ivanovich series, where she's got a kind of female bounty hunter who in fact looks for criminals who've gone missing from their bail bonds. And I'm also thinking of Elmore Leonard, who has figures throughout his fiction who are kind of on the fringes of the law. But in British crime fiction, particularly contemporary British crime fiction, it seems to be the police novel. And I think why that is because it's become more and more unlikely that private detectives or figures sort of outside the police force will have access to the kind of techniques and forensic procedures which are so vital in the capturing and the chasing of criminals in the contemporary period.
Michael, as a former private investigator yourself, can you tell us a bit about how your past life comes into your novels?
I worked everything from criminal cases to civil cases, the mundane of a background check to a successful death penalty defense case. And actually, we saw a woman released from death row after 10 years. All of that certainly feeds into the books. I want to try and get as many things right as possible. I want to try and bring some level of experience and reality to those books in a way that it's a little bit more than just escapist and maybe you are learning something about the procedures.
Would you say that you fall in a way into that category of the kind of psychological, emotional drama as well? I mean, in this one you've got the relationship between the two brothers, which
Is it Cain and Abel? Kent and Adam? Were you deliberately invoking Cain and Abel?
That's one of the most famous pairs of brothers, but yeah, certainly, yes, I fall into that psychological camp to an extent. And even with the supernatural books, if you look at a book like The Cypress House, that's a book that's, to me, the driving force there is the relationship between Arlen and Paul and Arlen and Rebecca. And so it's always about the emotional, the ways the events of the plot affect the journey of the character and affect them emotionally. And if they are not changed by the journey, then I don't really see the point of the story.
I want to bring in Peter here because you say interesting stuff about the compromises that being too over-invested in the scenario can involve. And you cite Joseph Wombat, who actually happens to be our next guest. And, I mean, he has some extraordinary stuff in his fiction, doesn't he? Such as he sort of has a revisionist reading of the Rodney King killing.
In his novel called Hollywood Station, which came out, I think, in 2006, it becomes clear that Wombau's sympathies, because he was a policeman himself, are very much for the cop characters in his world. And he's particularly incensed by the kind of level of regulation which has followed in the wake of the Rodney King beatings. He talks about race and he talks about ethnicity, but that sort of takes a back seat. There's no sense that anything can be changed in the social and institutional structures of the city to do anything about race or ethnicity at all. Society is the way it is the way it is. So his sympathy for the police force actually skews the book, to my mind anyway, in the direction of a conservative politics.
So thank you very much. And let's now hear from the man himself, Joseph Wombau, down the line from California.
From the pages of Joseph Wombau's controversial bestseller.
She left the world the same way she entered. Fetal position.
The victim.
That chained like a dog.
Nobody chains a dog like that.
The evidence.
The link marks on her body were identical to the chains in these pictures.
The manhunt.
We've already heard. I believe you started writing while you were working as a policeman, is that right?
Yes. I was working through my first three books. I stayed on the job after having written The New Centurions, which became a film with George C. Scott, and The Blue Knight, which became a miniseries with William Holden, and The Onion Field, which was my first nonfiction and later became a film. I stayed on the job through those three books, and then my fame or notoriety, if you will, became a bit too much, and I couldn't do police work anymore. People I arrested would ask me what George C. Scott was really like. Things like that. When my police partner, I was a detective at the time, started showing deference and opening the door of our car for me to get in, I said, that's it.
There's a rather enjoyable portrait in the very first scene of this book where you have a young sort of preppy policeman who's talking to two less educated, shall we say, ones. I was wondering whether there was a little bit of taking the mickey out of yourself in that, the different languages they speak. Is that the case?
Perhaps, you know, we put ourselves in our novels without meaning to sometimes.
This novel marks a return to Hollywood Station, which is very familiar from your novels, and people are still touching the Oracle's picture for luck, I gather.
The Hollywood Station novels, now total five, it was something that I started doing back in 2006. I started interviewing a lot of cops, particularly those who worked at Hollywood Station. Hollywood, by the way, is in the city of Los Angeles. It's a police division. I found that after interviewing 50 police officers, I had a lot of stories that I thought I could put together and come up with a novel. And that's how the first Hollywood Station came to be. The Oracle was an old sergeant, 69 years old, who'd been a cop for well over 40 years. In fact, he was from my day originally, as I conceived him. And he became a popular character. There's a photo of him in the Hollywood assembly room where the officers touch it for luck before they go out on the streets at night. The most important thing that he did, he expressed a sentiment that I feel in my heart and soul, and it's this: doing good police work is the most fun that you will ever have in your entire life. The Oracle told this to all of the young cops when they came to work at Hollywood Station, and they carried that with them. And that's something that I believe. And, you know, I've lived a lot for a long time since then, but nothing equals the fun that I had doing good police work.
Even writing novels?
Writing novels isn't fun until it's over. Writing novels is just dreadfully hard work. And can get tedious because I rewrite them 6 to 10 times every word, and I'm never sure if it's any good, and it's all rather painful until it's over.
Which do you enjoy most, writing about the cops and their banter and their life, or actually dealing with crime?
I think writing about the cops and their banter in all of my books, both fiction and nonfiction, actually. There's humor, gallows humor, defensive humor, police humor. There's wackiness, you know, because that's what it's a lot of it is about. And even in my most serious books, there's humor.
W. H. Auden referred to Los Angeles in connection with Chandler, actually, as the great wrong place. But you take a huge pleasure in the place, don't you? The ridiculousness of the place. So, for example, you have a lovely set piece of Hollywood street life with what street characters guarding their turf. So you get Wolfman and the Green Hornet stepping in to mediate a standoff between the Iron Man and Spider-Man.
Spider-Man stepped in front of the next pair of tourists and said, "Come on, folks, get your picture with a real superhero, not some pile of rusty nuts and bolts."
"Hey, Sticky Foot," Iron Man said. "No poaching."
Spider-Man replied, "Chill, Tin Man, or you might get your fenders dented." Iron Man, who had seen his namesake's movie 14 times and was feeling invincible, said, "Crawl back into your web, you fucking insect, or you might get my iron upside the head." And with that, he whacked Spider-Man across the skull with an iron gauntlet, except the iron was really molded plastic.
Those street characters, superheroes, are in costume and they panhandle in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater, the famous movie theater on Hollywood Boulevard, and pose for photos with tourists. Like the rest of us, they have their warts and they're jealous of each other and they take over each other's turf and fights start, and there have actually been brawls involving Superman and Batman and Marilyn Monroe, who's a transvestite.
So this is actually drawn from your experience. This actually happens.
Oh, yes. Oh, of course, yes. I take cops to dinner, 4 or 5 at a time, no more than that. Any more than that, they start talking to each other instead of to me, and I lose some of the good anecdotes. I can get all of the material I need after I interview about at least 50. I don't know why that's the number, but it is, to get enough for a novel. I can tell you this, the women officers are far better than the men as interviewees because they're fearless when it comes to talking. they will reveal themselves instantly, and they will communicate emotion, which is the stuff of novelists. The male cops need about 3.5 drinks to get them talking. The female officers only have to smell the cork, and off they go. And I just love interviewing the females. I never mix genders. If you do, it turns into a playground situation where the men will start showing off and the women will get angry and clam up.
Part of the plot, integral to the plot, is a Russian amputee fetishist. And you introduced me to a new word. Apotemnophilia, is that what it is?
That's close, yeah, that's it.
And we agreed on that, we're agreed on that. It is real black humor, isn't it?
You know, that sort of thing probably works best in Hollywood, you know, where anything goes, where all sorts of weird things pop up every day in the lives of the police officers. When I was told about that at an interview, I said, that's Hollywood.
And it actually did happen?
Oh, yes.
So now there's another strand to this, which involves longshoremen and the changing populations of the harbours. And Dinko Babic, who's part of the Croatian population, is very mournful about the takeover by Mexicans.
The Mexican population, of course, has grown exponentially in California and Los Angeles. The Croatians were great in terms of establishing the workforce of the longshoremen in Los Angeles and Long Beach harbors. But now, of course, they've gotten old and they're moving and the Mexicans are taking over. And that does create a certain conflict, as you can imagine. Mm. The character in the book, Dinko Babic, he falls in love with a 19-year-old Mexican dancer. And that creates a sort of tragic storyline of this love affair developing during a terrifying hunt for her by a murderer because she witnessed something that could get him arrested and put in prison for life.
Now, going along with this, it's a recurrent theme in your work, is how difficult it is to police this, with particularly with all the civil rights legislation, that the police feel weighed down by political correctness.
Los Angeles is really a melting pot. There are 200 languages, I think, spoken in the Los Angeles Unified School District. The white population of the city is less than 50%, the white Anglo population. The Hispanic population is just about equal. It creates some interesting conflict for someone to write about. I worked in the Latino community for my last 6 years on the police department, and I went to the trouble of learning Spanish, and I enjoyed the people quite a lot. And I've written about them in most of my novels, I think probably in an affectionate way.
But you nevertheless, you in one of your novels, you had dealt with the Rodney King. You had a sort of revisionist account of the Rodney King beating, didn't you? Which has become a byword among certain communities for institutional racism. And you take the line that, oh, it was just a couple of rogue cops.
Yeah, Rodney King was a thug. He wasn't just a motorist. He was an ex-convict, strong-arm robber. He was a thug. And unfortunately, the wrong police sergeant was out there at the end of that long pursuit when what should have been done, as anyone with common sense could see, they should have swarmed him and handcuffed the thug and be done with it. Instead, that sergeant took the tack that until he surrendered, he instructed his officers to whack him with their batons. It was absolutely wrong, that approach, but it was an anomaly. That's not the way it's done. That's not the way I'd ever seen it done. But that doesn't make Rodney King any less of a thug.
Is there a sense that you feel that you're sounding the cause of the police in your novels?
I'm trying to show that it's not as easy as one thinks to judge something from a quick look at a video. What we learned as young police officers right out of the police academy was there are two sides to every story. When you go to a family dispute, do not take one side of it. You must hear both sides because they will be very different. So officers always separated the combatants in family dispute situations and talked to them separately. Well, the Rodney King story had two sides to it. And I just think that people shouldn't judge from what they saw at the end of that video. And I can tell you this, when those riots started after the Rodney King beating, most of the people who were interviewed after being arrested didn't know who in the hell Rodney King was. and couldn't have cared less. They just joined in. Why? Because it was there, and that's why they did it. And they hadn't a clue about Rodney King. So these are the things that I think I sort of have an obligation to bring out if I'm going to tell the truth in my novels. I don't whitewash the police. Far from it. You know, I present them with all of their failings, warts and all. The cops in my book can be womanizers, commit suicide, and suffer. And I suppose this is why they call me the father of the modern police novel. I've always felt that I didn't want to write a police procedural. A police procedural tells how the cop acts on the job. I wanted to flip that. I wanted to tell how the job acts on the cop. Therefore, my novels about police are more psychological stories. You're going to find out what happens inside the head of the cop, which is more important than what he does on the job. In my most famous nonfiction book, The Onion Field, it's a story of two cops in Hollywood, true story, kidnapped by two small-time robbers, and one of them is murdered, the other escapes. The importance of the story is that it was the first book to ever deal with something that we now call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So it was a story of the surviving cop who suffered from PTSD in the most horrendous way, and how he was badly treated by the police department, who did not understand the phenomenon. So that's what I've always been interested in, how the job acts on the cop, not necessarily how the cop acts on the job.
Joseph Wombau there, and Harbour Nocturne is published by Head of Zeus. We'll be returning to crime next week when we hear Kate Summerscale talking about her prize-winning book, The Suspicions of Mr. Witcher. Ostensibly, it's the story of a sensational Victorian murder, but her extensive research led her also to write a history of the beginnings of both the crime novel and the first English detectives. By the way, if you're in London this month at all, there's an exhibition at the British Library devoted to the history of crime fiction, so we're really on the money with this podcast. And that's it from us for this week. Do let us know what you think of the programme by going to the podcast page on guardian.co.uk/books. We do love talking to our listeners. And thanks to Agent Graves for getting in touch after we quoted you in last week's programme. A book is in the post to you. For now, thanks to Gillian Flynn, Joseph Wombau, Michael Carita and Peter Messant. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer collaborator, Tim Mabey, farewell, my lovelies.
Visit audible.co.uk/guardianaudio to choose from a selection of over 60,000 titles. With Audible, you can make more time for books by downloading and listening wherever you are and whatever you're doing.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.